Sign up today for the Film Comment Letter. It's a free weekly digital newsletter featuring original film criticism and writing by Film Comment's editors and brilliant contributors.
The letter delivers exclusive features, reviews, interviews, streaming picks, news, and more directly to subscribers' inboxes before they're published on filmcomment.com the following Monday.
Sign up today at filmcomment.com.
Welcome to the Film Comment Podcast. I'm Clinton Crute.
And I'm Devika Girish. We're the editors of Film Comment.
The big night is almost here. That's right, the Academy Awards are just around the corner. Before the winners are revealed on Sunday, we teamed up with some West Coast colleagues, the editors of the Los Angeles Review of Books, to preview this year's nominees.
Eric Newman, editor-at-large at LARB, and Annie Burke, the publication's film editor, joined us for a special collaboration with the LARB Radio Hour. We had spirited debates about all of the Best Picture nominees, from Oppenheimer to Killers of the Flower Moon to The Holdovers, and also talked about trends, surprises, and snubs.
A little bit about the Los Angeles Review of Books. It is a reader-supported online magazine and quarterly print journal that publishes incisive, rigorous, and engaging writing on contemporary literature and culture.
If you're interested in supporting their mission, consider becoming a member at lareviewofbooks.org/membership, where you can get access to LARB's exclusive book club featuring members-only chats with editors and luminary authors, in addition to a subscription to their quarterly journal.
We hope you enjoy the conversation.
I'm thrilled to welcome my guests for our 2024 Oscars preview discussion in partnership with Film Comment. In just a few minutes, we'll break down the year in film, talk about what we loved, what we hated, what uplifted us, and maybe what disappointed us, which, at least for me, was a fair amount of film this year. But before we get to that, let me first welcome my esteemed guest for this year's Oscar chat. First up, we have Annie Burke. Hi, Annie.
Hi. Nice to see you again.
Nice to see you, too. Annie is a culture writer and one of LARB's film and TV editors. Her work has appeared in The Washington Post, The Village Voice, The New Republic, Literary Hub, and The New York Times. Her book on women writers in the 1950s television, titled Their Own Best Creations, Women Writers in Postwar Television, was published in 2022 by the University of California Press. This year, we're also thrilled to be joined by Devika Girish. Hi, Devika.
Hey, Eric. Thanks for having me on the podcast.
Lovely to have you as well. Devika is a writer and critic whose work regularly appears in the New York Times, as well as The Village Voice, The Nation, Reverse Shot, The New York Review of Books, and many other publications. Devika is also co-editor of Film Comment. And finally, along those lines, it's my pleasure to welcome Clinton Crute, Film Comment's co-editor. Hi, Clinton.
Hi, everybody. Pleasure to be here.
To get us started, I was wondering if we could just talk a little bit about the year in film from, let's say, like kind of an industry perspective. Obviously, we had two huge strikes that upended much of the creative business this year. That would be the SAG-AFTRA strike and the WGA strike for the writers. But that wasn't the only disruption the industry experienced. There are, of course, including up to right this week, rising concerns about the impact of AI on the film industry, lingering concerns over audiences' failure to return in great numbers to the cinema, a trend it seems that even Barbenheimer couldn't reverse, and the continuing dominance of streamers as what we might think of as vanguards of a new studio system. And this all kind of plagued the world of movies, both how they're promoted and who, if anyone, is going to see them. So let me start with you, Annie. What was your take on the year in film?
Well, as someone who watched the Taylor Swift Eras Tour documentary on Christmas Day, I would say one sort of trend, not necessarily in the industry, but in the discourse around the industry, I felt like it was, you know, they talk about like hot girl summer. I feel like it was like empowered woman summer fall with Barbie and Poor Things. I wrote a little bit about this and other people did too, that essentially Barbie and Poor Things are the same movie. Like it's kind of like a BuzzFeed quiz. Like, are you a Barbie or are you a Bella? And I think that the Eras Tour is not a part of that. But I wanted to, before we get into conversations about the Oscar movies, I want to talk about a movie that didn't get an Oscar and isn't part of these conversations, but I feel like belongs in Empowered Woman Fall, which was Polite Society, which is a great film about an aspiring stuntwoman teenager that I feel like more than any other film this year really sort of formally plays with the kind of like feminist politics that I feel like a lot of other more buzzy films try to argue or discuss or present in a fun way. Maybe this sounds like a superficial ad, but it stayed with me. Like even the Stooges and the bodyguards in Polite Society are played by women. And I don't think I've ever seen that, having gone to a girl's school growing up. I don't think I've ever seen the tough guys played by girls, except when it's required by sort of the school play vibe. So it does have a bit of a like school play vibe in that sense, but it's incredibly fun pastiche. It's so great. I wish that that had gotten more conversations. I think that partially, I don't know if Polite Society got a very big theatrical run. I don't think it did at all. It's like on Peacock, which only, you know, one out of 10 people has Peacock. Like maybe if Peacock's lucky, they have those kinds of numbers. So I feel
don't underestimate the Housewives fan base.
I know. Also Premier League Soccer is on Peacock, which I know and is going to draw a certain group. Maybe not the same people who watch Polite Society, but maybe. So I think I struggle with this narrative about like bringing everyone back to the theater as much as I like to, as one of the, my favorite films of the year is like nobody saw it in theaters and you had to be part of a sort of a niche streamer to see it. So that's one thing, but I'd love to throw it to someone else now.
I mean, for me, what I'm struck by looking at this year's nominations is that I don't see a very clear trend. If you look at the Best Picture nominees, it's a really eclectic basket of films. You have something like Past Lives, which is by a director who doesn't have big name recognition, Celine Song, and also doesn't have, again, stars that have a lot of name recognition and is a film you would consider independent. It is an A24 film, and I think we can talk about what A24's place is in the current industry landscape. So that, and I actually am not a huge fan of Past Lives, but it is still kind of heartening to see it up there. And then you have Anatomy of a Fall, which I think this post-Parasite world where international films are increasingly kind of being counted amongst just the regular categories. And I think, again, I'm not so huge. I'm not as hot on Anatomy of a Fall as a lot of people are. I was a little cooler on it. But again, just really exciting to see it up there as both a non-American film. It features three different languages, English, German, and French, which I wonder how those calculations, you know, that determine what is a non-English language film or what's a foreign film. I'm always curious about what films make that cut and what don't. But it is, yeah, it's a bit surprising in a positive way to see it there. And it's also a strange film. Again, despite my reservations toward it, it's a film of many different tones. It is not a film that has an easy resolution. And so that feels pretty exciting to see it in the Best Picture basket. And the other film that I was pretty interested to see there was American Fiction, which, you know, again, like I saw it at Toronto last year. I enjoyed it. I had some reservations. I thought it was, again, interesting for, it's not quite a blockbuster, but it is kind of a mainstream commercial film, but like quite smart for that category of big screen movies. I also did not expect it to crack the Best Picture section just because I think it's kind of thorny in ways that I thought might not really.
You think that corny movies are not allowed
thorny,
to crack the Best
not
Picture?
Corny.
Oh.
Thorny.
Thorny.
Yeah.
Thorny.
I heard corny too. And I agreed, but I was
a little bit
sure.
No. Corny is like, is the target audience. No, I mean, thorny in ways that it's not necessarily like a very easily morally digestible movie. So that also I thought was interesting. But, you know, to me, the great tragedy is that my number one movie of the year didn't make it, which is May December. To me, that is the perfect film, the best American film of this year.
The perfect film.
I think it is a perfect film. I said that like as soon as I saw it last year, I thought it was just perfect in the way that Todd Haynes' movies are so well calibrated and kind of hit every note. And
it does seem like a movie that would be palatable to Oscar voters too. Like,
well, there were a lot of
like overt ways.
I don't know, because I did talk to people, especially older people who I think really could not stomach the
tonal mix of the movie and the fact that it was about right. abuse and about child abuse, but that it was also funny and salacious and complicated. And so I think that might have been a factor in it not winning the audiences that I hoped it would.
May-December was also one of my top movies of the year. Also empowered women, but like kind of like turning it on its head and then like spitting in it. And,
well, yeah, exploitative women.
Yeah. I think that when you I can see putting it next to American Fiction, I can sort of understand why the Academy would feel like they were, when you talk about thorny films, like they would feel like they're taking something on a little bit edgy when they give praise to American Fiction, which is a softer, more commercial satire. In a way that, like, I really loved American Fiction is the kind of movie I watch when I just like want to sit down and watch a movie, and I don't want to watch a Hallmark movie, and I don't want to watch like a 3-hour foreign film. I want to watch something like American Fiction, like watch it with my family, whatever, because it's funny and it's smart. But May-December, I think, has like a lot of the same media critique, but it's vicious. It's like takes no prisoners in a way.
And it's fundamentally weird. I think it's fundamentally kind of just a weird movie.
It's a weird movie, but I can see why the Academy would be like, they feel like they're doing something like May-December with American Fiction. But
I think Anatomy of a Fall kind of falls into that category as well, even though I think at heart it's sort of a Hollywood courtroom drama.
It's so interesting to hear you guys talk, because May-December, I did not expect to make it onto this list. I also loved it in just the same ways that you guys are talking about. But I think that it's, to me, the kind of Academy's aversion to camp, which is a huge part of that film. I think it's everything from its kind of like 90s melodrama after school movie string music as transitions between scenes to the kind of that final line that I can't stop saying to my husband, she's not that kind of snake, you know, like that. Like, it's great. It's very iconic. It's amazing performances. But I think it's the campiness and exactly as Devika is pointing out, the kind of tonal unevenness, which is, I think, part of the frisson that gives the film its grip. It's what makes it interesting, is that we're laughing, but also horrified. But then we're also laughing again. And then maybe we're attracted, but also repulsed. You know, it's got everything. And I think, too, Devika, your note about American Fiction, and similar, Annie, it's like, I could watch Jeffrey Wright in anything, and he is incredible. He is Jeffrey Wright in that movie. But I think that movie also doesn't exactly know what it wants to be, but because it's pulling at several different threads, all of which are sharp, but which for me never fully cohere into a whole in a way that's super satisfying. But, you know, I think that it's easier because of the topics that it's addressing and that it never moves into camp, even though it goes into comedy. I think that's probably why we see American Fiction in a way that we don't see May-December.
May-December is the campier title, but in a way, if you look, and this might be a little pointed or paranoid, but if you look at the character that Adam Brody plays in American Fiction versus Natalie Portman in May-December, like, no one's going to feel called out by the executive in American Fiction. No one's going to see themselves in that character. But I would put down money that someone, at least some Academy voters, watched May-December and felt seen. They felt accused. That kind of like the quiet affairs on the set, not the big splashy sexy ones, but the quietly seedy relationships that emerge between actors and producers, agents, directors, the kind of the pretend sort of research that's being done that's really just prurience and ego. And like, that is actually not played very campily. Those are some of the quieter, more sort of quote unquote realist moments as her on the phone. Yeah, I really do think that's a big reason why May-December was not rewarded. I think it was too mean to the people who would have to reward it.
I mean, I think that now that you're saying that, I think one trend among all the Best Picture, not all of them, but many of the Best Picture nominees is a kind of moralism. I think everything from The Zone of Interest, Oppenheimer, Killers of the Flower Moon, American Fiction do have a kind of easier, I think, moralism to them, which I can imagine voters feeling good about promoting these movies.
Isn't that like
as
an
some
Oscar
kind of
tradition though?
Yeah, as like exactly as a way of kind of acknowledging, you know, their complicity or acknowledging kind of the great political tragedies of our times. And then you have something like May-December, which is morally a lot more gray. In fact, it like strays away from moralism, not in any not that it condones anything, you know, about its premise, but that it does not offer very easy positions for a viewer to occupy either. And I mean, yeah, I guess I think Clint is right. Like, that's always sort of been the case. And what's interesting to me is, like, even the films that don't fall into that category, like Anatomy of a Fall or Poor Things, I think kind of feign complexity, but are at the end quite morally simple.
Can we talk about what I think is the real outlier, which is Barbie? Because historically, comedies, and this is a movie in which, you know, film executives might see themselves in Will Ferrell's character. I'm not sure how many of them were like, I'm like a doofy cartoon character. It might be kind of flattering. But I think that, I think for a lot of reasons, its inclusion here is interesting. Number one, because I don't think it's necessarily a very good movie, although, you know, it's pleasant in some ways. But I'm not sure that I consider it to be like one of the best movies of the year. But I do think that it is kind of it's the industry, the fact that it's included here is the industry kind of patting itself on the back for creating like an industrial epic. This is a movie about a toy produced by Mattel. And it shows how great this product, this plastic product, can be as a tool for liberation. And so, like, I don't know. To me, first of all, it's strange that it's a comedy and that it's made this list at all, because generally that doesn't happen. And second of all, I think that, like, the fact that it's about a toy, as I'm sure we all know, is sort of like a complicated issue.
I mean, Toy Story.
Those toys weren't toys beforehand, though.
Yeah.
They only became real-life toys after.
I don't know how much I would say that the Academy is patting itself on its back with Barbie because of the lack of nominations in other categories for Margot Robbie or Greta Gerwig. I do think it is unusual that it's a comedy, but it is also just such a movie with such a strong, heavy-handed political, cultural method. So I feel like that almost outweighs the comedic aspect. You know, the speech that America Ferrera gives, you know, that's kind of, I think that's like very much Oscar bait. So to me, it doesn't seem unusual that it made it, also given that it was, you know, the amount of bank it made and the profits it raked in at the box office. Also, I did not think it was a great movie. I'm someone who really loves Greta Gerwig's work, and I was pretty disappointed by it. But I also think it is, one must concede that it is smarter than one would expect it to be. And that Greta has, especially, I think maybe not narratively, but visually, it's doing a lot of interesting things. And it exudes a sense of craftsmanship. And so that is also something that a big commercial crowd-pleasing movie with like a simple feminist message that also has glimmers of like auteurship is, I think, just made for the awards.
It's absolutely like, it manages to turn Barbie, the intellectual property, into an underdog. And that's just like, what a feat. I don't know how I think that, as I've said on social media, and I stand by it, even though Barbie would not be my best picture of the year, like the extent to which the film works to me is in Gerwig's direction more than the screenplay, which I didn't think was such a hot screenplay, if I'm being totally honest. I thought that was a weak point. I think Ryan Gosling is so much fun, but like the first word I would think of him in that movie is game. He's game more than he's anything. He's just like game to play. And like, what a surprise to see that from him. That made me think about this upcoming Oscars casting. I was like, oh, Barbie had incredible casting. I don't like, they just cast it really well. Good. Good for them. But I think that from when I was a kid to now, there's this desire to put a few popular titles that everyone has seen in the best picture. And because it has what you say, this kind of these glimmers of auteurism, it seems like a perfect fit. But I don't think it will win best picture. And I don't think anyone will be surprised if it doesn't. And I think if it did, it would be kind of an upset. Again, a bizarre upset from Mattel. Like, how do I keep coming back to Barbie as an underdog when it's, you know, a conglomerate? It's just like pretty brilliant. They've managed to flip the script. I do want to say about Will Ferrell as an executive, I was really surprised watching that movie that he is not a villain, that they just decided not to make him a villain. And I've been chewing on that since I saw it. I haven't been chewing on the America Ferrera monologue. It hit me in the moment and then I forgot about it. But I've been thinking about Will Ferrell as an executive. And I can't explain, I couldn't at the time figure out, is this a joke that she can't make him a villain because it's a Mattel movie? Mm. Or is it like really that she's just kind of like, that this wants to be a gentle, kind movie where no one is really mm-hmm. a bad guy, and that the patriarchy like isn't really fully entrenched because the only real patriarch who's a doll like isn't even bad. I haven't come to a conclusion, but I would like to say in closing, Singing in the Rain, when the studio chief says, like, do you think I would steal the labor of this young woman without... I think the best thing I can come up with it is a very, very, like, through a Funhouse mirror reference to Singing in the Rain, when they, you know, the idea that the man in power would, with his all his power, would never dream of actually abusing it and mobilizing it against a young, beautiful, blonde woman. Like, that he's not that kind of guy or something. Of course, he tried to put her in a box like an hour earlier, so I don't know what I'm saying anymore.
This is one of the weird things, actually, to me about Barbie, is that I will admit, so I did the Barbenheimer thing, you know, like separated by a day. I saw them very close together. It's like, I will say, I actually thought more about Barbie after watching it than I thought about Oppenheimer after watching
it.
And I think that part of it is these open-ended or unresolved questions about both like its representation of the kind of gender struggle, but also its possible futures. Like, it has a lot of weird and very unreconciled like sense of like, well, how, I mean, to the simple question of like, well, how could we make a more egalitarian world? I think that Barbie is kind of like, in the end, maybe we can't. And that was the thing that I just kept getting me hung up. And then, of course, obviously, it's also very enjoyable. So it has these like, it's odd to me that it felt more intellectually stimulating than the movie that I was drummed over the head to believe was going to be intellectually stimulating and somehow better in 70 millimeter, which was Oppenheimer.
Oof.
Do we, I mean, do we really want to talk need about Oppenheimer? To dig this corpse up? And
yeah, because we, shameless plug, but Clint and I recorded an episode of the Film Comment podcast dedicated to Oppenheimer right when it came out. A very kind of long discussion where Clint and I were the naysayers and we had two of our wonderful contributors who were champions. And let me tell you, it stirred up many comments on the internet. But I don't know if I have much more to add to the barrage that of opinions we presented on that episode, but this is what I keep coming back to. I think there are many moral, political issues with the film, but it's also just badly made. And somehow people seem very... Eric, you're kind of making a face. And that's been... it's like, this is one movie that has made me feel like, am I just seeing differently? You know, sometimes you're you know, some people are going to like this. I'm just like, am I just seeing differently? Everything is very poorly written. It doesn't look good.
The acting is like, it's not even, and I don't believe it's the actor's fault. We can talk about like the acting nominees. I believe Emily Blunt is nominated for a supporting actor. I don't know how to feel
about
that.
Well, she did get really drunk and threw a bottle. I mean, she played a bitter alcoholic woman. And that is, you know.
That's like checking a box, right?
The Academy.
But I think that, you know, I don't know. We talked about this already. So it's like, I'm just going back over the same things. But like, I think he does a real disservice to the actors in this film.
The fact that they have to say those lines.
The filmmaking, they have to say things that, and like, human people don't behave this way, but they're being asked to and somehow make that realistic. I guess it's a feat of acting. Like, I guess she deserves the award. I'm gonna actually change my entire story.
I thought that the highlight of the film for me was Emily Blunt in that courtroom, that little like conference room. The conference room hearing was the best part of Oppenheimer, and it took us like 2.5 hours to get there. I liked it because it didn't feel like Christopher Nolan, and I'm not a fan of Christopher Nolan. I'm not from Boston, but I do feel like he thinks he's better than me. And I think that's what people say. Do you think you're better than me? I don't know. I think I learned that from that Ben Affleck Duncan commercial. Anyway, the point is,
I'm from New Jersey.
You think you're better than me? He's not better. Ever since his movies, like ever since Inception, I was like, I don't think this makes sense. And I think he thinks he's smarter than me, but I'm not sure if I'm stupid or if he's stupid. And then I saw Dunkirk and I was like, well, I'm not stupid. Like, And then I saw Oppenheimer and I was like, wow, okay. Like, I think that his big history films reveal that maybe he's not all he's cracked up to be. I was going to say the Emperor Has No Clothes, but that might be too harsh. I think he's actually a fine maker, but I don't think there's a lot of big ideas there. And he took on a very, very big idea with the nuclear bomb. Yeah. Like, very, very big. One of the biggest. Globally, catastrophically big. And I don't think he had the thinking mind for it.
Yeah, I think it's a very simplistic movie that is made to seem complicated through lots of unnecessary cutting back and forth and changes in the color palette. And, you know,
loud sounds happening. Yeah,
Cillian Murphy has that beautiful, sad, sharp, cheekboned face. He has like a good face for this. He's a good actor, but like he looks like Christopher Nolan. You didn't make him. Like, you were lucky. You got his
face. But you know who's good in it? I will say Robert Downey Jr., I think, is probably very good.
Yeah. If anyone in that movie...
He, to me, is the only person who comes out of the Oppenheimer fiasco, dare I say.
Unscathed.
I was very happy to see David Krumholtz. He's always a good time. I just like seeing him in things.
Except
he didn't have much to do.
There's the scene when Oppenheimer learns all these languages in Germany, right? Aren't he supposed to be learning Dutch? And then it turns out that he's like, let me display my Dutch. But then somebody was saying, correct me if I'm wrong, this might be just like an anecdote that I picked up somewhere, but somebody was like, that's not Dutch he's speaking. It's like, you know, some variant of Flemish. Maybe we could cut this because we can't fact check it. But nonetheless, like...
Oh, wait, we hung out with a Amsterdam-based programmer. And he was saying they couldn't, like, find someone to, write, like, actual Dutch dialogue. Now, we cannot confirm this, not knowing Dutch ourselves, but this is...
It lacks precision in the movie. It lacks precision. And I think the scene where they, you know, are all cheering because the bomb has dropped, but you can see the explosion, it's... looks very startling. And then I went home and thought, what did it mean though? Was that what he was thinking? Is that what I'm supposed to be thinking? Is that what Christopher Nolan wants us to know that he's thinking about that? Right. Imprecise. Like, you have to land it when you're making a movie like this.
I would like to relate.
I think he's going to win.
A little side story about Oppenheimer.
I think he's going to win too.
I think he's going to win too, because again, people love simple moral ideas presented bombastically. And people love movies that tell them, we must feel guilty for our historical sins, but it's okay. And that's kind of, to me, the undercurrent of the movie.
It's okay because we feel bad.
Exactly.
About it, right?
But it's fine. It had to happen and we feel bad. So you can walk out here with a clean slate. A little side story about Oppenheimer. So there is, as you know, the Bhagavad Gita, which is a Hindu epic, features in the movie. And one of the worst scenes in that movie...
I was waiting for somebody to talk about this. It is truly the craziest.
I don't even
want
to think about it.
I know. It is so making me awful.
Gag.
Is Oppenheimer being fucked by the character playing Florence Pugh, another extremely underserved woman character in this film.
Yes.
And she asks him to read aloud from the Bhagavad Gita while she has sex with him, which to me is not how humans have sex, as far as I know, and does not represent anything erotic to me. But
now, Devika, don't kink shame.
Fair enough.
You know what? I think shame is good. This is my new policy in life. Bring back a little shame. And I thought that was just a horrible piece of, like, a horribly written, imagined scene. And I tweeted, you know, sort of a criticism of Oppenheimer, and I kind of snarkily tweeted about the scene, which I also thought was kind of offensive. I tweeted it out. I wake up the next morning. It's like blowing up. And all these Hindu right-wing people are quote tweeting it, being like, this movie should be banned. It's insulting the Bhagavad Gita. And I'm just like, can I just say that this scene is bad without the right-wing just like co-opting this? And the thing is, I actually do think it's offensive. I don't think that it should be banned, and I don't think it's some like great offense to my culture. I think it's offensive in that it is extremely poorly and clumsily written. And then also, when the movie finally got to India, the scene where they're both sitting, Florence Pugh and Cillian Murphy are sitting and they're nude. I think it's when he goes to visit her before.
Just covered in a layer of grease and sweat.
And
I can't get it out of my mind.
I guess the Indian censor board had them make a VFX bodysuit for Florence Pugh so she wouldn't be naked in that scene. And that was circulating online. And truly, the VFX award should go to whoever did that, because it looks so realistic and they did such a good job of making it look like she's wearing some black bodysuit. So I just wanted to relate this little side anecdote about Oppenheimer's, the movie's struggles in India.
So, like a Catwoman, like a full, like a...
No. More style, like it's like short and it's not particularly sexy looking. It's just like a black cloth. Yeah.
Because I was going to be like, I don't know if that makes it much better. If it's going to be like a full on like leather. Oh, wow. Okay. That's just going to make it like a little bit more niche, but not even much. Yeah.
Isn't he also naked in that scene? He didn't have a bodysuit?
I don't know. I'm just talking about the scene I saw circulate on social media, which featured Florence Pugh, but yeah.
We should probably move on, I think, from Oppenheimer, because my question, though, is if no one here liked Oppenheimer, Annie, did you?
I did not like Oppenheimer. Sorry, that wasn't clear.
What does it mean that, like, the critical consensus, is the critical consensus kind of?
A lot of critics did love it, so maybe there is. I think Richard Brody had like a wonderful pan that articulated a lot of my criticisms, but I think a lot of critics did love it.
So I don't know, maybe it says nothing, but I do think it's probably going to win, right?
It has all the trappings of a smart, ambitious historical film. I would argue it's more of a biopic, and Oscars love biopics, and I don't.
Mm-hmm.
But I think... why I think it will win is because it
feigns importance.
It has the illusion of intelligence and moral sort of strength, as you mentioned, but it doesn't, it's not too tricky. It's not too tricky and challenging, except if you overthink, which is like, well, I felt like I was like, well, who's thinking about what's happening to the Japanese in this scene? Like whose point of view? I have problems with point of view shots. I'll be like, but who's looking and I feel like I'm alone caring about that.
One detail that I encountered online after watching the movie that really bugged me, and it kind of relates to, it could be a segue to talking about some other stuff in the lineup, in the Best Picture lineup, is that, to my understanding, a bunch of communities of Native people who lived at Los Alamos were displaced in order for this ranch to be turned into the, you know, laboratory setting for the development of the bomb. And many people in the area still suffer from the after effects of radiation. I think a Native scholar tweeted about this. And the fact that the movie kind of positions Oppenheimer as this politically correct guy, you know, there's a meeting, I believe, with, I can't now remember exactly who, but like a defense secretary type person, or maybe it's someone in high up in the government.
Matt Damon's character.
And he's like, what should we do with Los Alamos now that the bomb has been developed? And Oppenheimer says in the movie, give it back to the Indians. And the fact that actually even buying and developing that site involved like this violent displacement is elided, that is already annoying to me. But then to make him seem like, give him this sort of zinger. And
well, they contaminated the site. It's like,
yeah, and so
they're not giving it back the same way that they
Yeah, and I don't think every movie needs to touch upon everything and every little historical detail, but it does feel like this movie, it gives Oppenheimer too much credit in every way. Also framing him as some kind of genius when clearly he was more of a bureaucrat or a manager than...
oh, who knows? It's impossible to tell from the movie.
I know, like, that's, I it's more like the problem is that it's... yeah.
Yeah.
But I wanted to make a segue from that to a couple things. One is, you know, I think Killers of the Flower Moon, which is very much about Native genocide. And I think it's a very different kind of movie about complicity and, you know, and guilt as Western white peoples. And what do we do with these histories that were always told from one side? And what do we do to atone for things that happened a long time ago, but whose benefits we still reap, right? And I think that's, to me, I have a lot of reservations also with Killers of the Flower Moon, but it's such a, so much better at kind of facing up to those questions in a complex way than Oppenheimer.
Do you think that might just be because the filmmaking is so much better? I mean, again, we were talking about how
it really
like,
is
the inaccuracies and like
You know, I think the form and content...
The question's about point of view.
Yeah, form and content are not entirely separable in this regard. I think Killers of the Flower Moon is a much more intelligent film, and that intelligence mm-hmm. is also in its telling. You know, the way mm-hmm. it's structured and paced and the way it uses different points of view. You know, even the... I think my complaint, which I have said many times on the Film Comment podcast, so our listeners might be a little tired of hearing me say it, is that...
You can just skip 15 seconds ahead now.
I don't think that it really... I think that its concession of screen space and perspective to indigenous characters doesn't go far enough. It feels like a concession. It feels a little bit obligatory. But at the same time, you also kind of sense that Scorsese is grappling very sincerely with questions of what it means to tell the story that has to, in a way, center the white perpetrators to some extent, because the story is about the white mafia, if you can put it that way. But, you know, and many Native viewers have expressed that critique as well, that it doesn't feel adequately told from the Native community's point of view. And I really kind of resent the critique that many people have put forward that it is a story about white guilt. So it has to, it's not really a story about the Native experience. It's a story about white people's conspiratorial and murderous, you know, regime. But I think that's a bit of a cop-out. I think you can very well tell stories about white people's murder, you know, murderousness and conspiracies without making them the protagonists of the tale. And that does, to me, limit the effect of the film.
I mean, I think, Devika, that I agree with everything that you're saying. I think that related is that, for me, I think what you're saying about Scorsese struggling, and like you see the struggle in the realization of the film, I think is absolutely right. And there should be some credit for that. But I just walked away from that film feeling two things. One, and this related to what you were saying, we really didn't get much interiority from the indigenous perspective. Like, there were lots of things that I would have loved to see explored. Why do they end up marrying all of these, like, white guys? Like, there is something going on there that's part of it.
The loose, yeah. The absolute bottom of the heap white guys, too. They're not going to, like, Brahmin. They're not finding, like, these fancy landed men and like, merging fortunes. Right. Not that I'm promoting that, but I am promoting that. Do that. They won't need to kill you.
You can't have it both ways, where you show these Native women as regal and so intelligent in order to, like, make it seem like you're doing positive portrayals of Native characters. And at the same time, not explain to us how they are, like, completely blind to the obvious shortcomings of the men they're marrying. Lily Gladstone's character exudes gravitas and intelligence. I can understand why these women would end up marrying those men, but show me those reasons. Like, right, show
that's what
me
I mean.
The reasons.
Yes, I'm not saying it's a wild intellectual leap. And then the other part that is a struggle for me in that movie is it cannot seem to, and I don't know if this is Scorsese's relationship with Leonardo DiCaprio or what, it seems like it cannot let go of the fact that maybe this guy, just maybe, is like a pure villain. Like, maybe he's just a bad guy through and through. And it seems like
a dumb bad guy too,
and a dumb bad guy.
Flashes of Fargo in this movie, where I was thinking dumb,
bumbling,
like dumb criminals. Like, if somebody's going to end up in a wood chipper, if those had been invented in that movie, someone would have been in that by.
And I think that's where we get this weird flip-flopping texturization of that character, where on the one hand, he's bullied by his uncle, or he doesn't know that. But then we'll see other cuts and he feels very connected to his wife, Lily Gladstone. But then we see other cuts where he's stealing from corpses. Like, it's so bizarre. And that even in the end, it seems like Lily Gladstone has to be the one that finally delivers the condemning sentence, you know, when she says, "What was in that medicine that you gave me? You know, what were you giving me, basically?" And this guy who, earlier in the film, we kind of have to suspend disbelief that, like, oh, he knows it's bad, but maybe doesn't think it's so bad. Oh, it's just to slow her down. Like, none of this makes any sense. Yeah. Like, I would not slowly poison my husband unless I'm like, well, actually, What She's I do gone. Want to do is kill
and
him.
Get some
That's
money.
That's what I want to do.
I think and he is not money. A very yeah. complex character, and the movie tries too hard to make him complex. And Lily Gladstone's yeah. character is very complex, and the movie just doesn't put any effort in drawing out those complexities. And I have to say that
instead, it kind of sets her on a pedestal, don't
exactly.
you feel like? There's like these scenes of...
And the fact that, again, you... It's so unclear. Like sometimes I almost worry that the movie furthers kind of this idea of the inevitability of what happened by not really showing us why the indigenous women and people in general sort of fell for this con. You know, if it had showed us a little more like what were the specific factors that made them mm-hmm. kind of be taken up by these men or...
It's an agency problem.
It's an agency, exactly.
It's like, what's the agency?
Can I speak on behalf of the film for just like 1 second? Yeah. Which is,
sure.
I thought it was exciting to watch. It's like, mm-hmm. I think some of it feels a little bit like a horror movie, like, why are you going in the basement kind of mm-hmm. vibe. Mm-hmm. But I think having revisited in my imagination and watched some of these films in the past couple of weeks, thinking about Oppenheimer, thinking about Maestro, like Killers of the Flower Moon, and this is not going to make me sound like the highbrow film critic I want to be. It's a movie. Like, dang, it's 3.5 hours. It's like, I want to know what happens. I'm so excited. I have feelings. I don't know what's happening, but I'm feeling a lot about it. Like, I'm
right.
just totally riveted. And that is not to put aside. And like, just like there are political and sort of icky problems with American fiction, which as a white woman who sees herself in some of those publishing characters, I'm like, I don't even think my opinion should come into that. I feel like I just watch it and shut up. And Killers of the Flower Moon, there are problems. I found the cameo at the end, at the risk of spoiling, and the final image of the tribe to be centering and pandering and wrong. Like, I don't know how you end that movie, but that was not it. But I can't put aside the fact that of that list of films, it was one of the most purely, viscerally exciting and sort of like compelling, dramatic pieces that I saw. It was more compelling to me than Barbie. It was more compelling. I liked Anatomy of a Fall. I really admired it. But Killers of the Flower Moon, like, I wanted to see every minute of it. I didn't want to miss a minute.
I think it's, to me, it's the best of the list. But I also think that everything you guys are saying is accurate. I think what makes the movie still valuable to me is that I think you can see the process of the film kind of realizing the inadequacy of its script, the inadequacy of its project to the questions that it keeps raising to itself. Mm-hmm. And I think I don't necessarily think that the cameo at the end works. Like, I found that to be kind of hokey too. But I think that it's a, to me, what
are you doing
what
here?
Does
That's
work?
How I said out loud.
I completely disagree.
I don't think it knows what it wants to say ultimately. But I think it discovers that I think it starts as a movie, and clearly the project started as a movie that was very clearly, had a very clearly articulated idea at its heart. But as the movie was made, it seems to me that things kind of like became complicated.
Well, that is actually what happened, which is that they had a script,
sure.
but they brought on consultants, Osage consultants, and then rewrote the script in response to feedback about not the Osage people not being centered enough. And I don't think that necessarily was realized, that feedback was necessarily fully realized.
I think that like what makes the film ultimately admirable is that it's sincerity in the face of the failure of its ideas. So it's sort of watching itself fail to say anything important, but it sincerely kind of owns
Lily
that.
Gladstone a lot
and
to then, carry the
and
weight.
On, yeah.
Well,
yeah.
I think the cameo actually is what really embodies what you're saying, Clint, about the movie witnessing its own failure. And I was really moved by the cameo.
But it's like an emo moment where I'm like, it's kind of...
I cried when he came on stage. I think we can spoil it at this time. At this point.
I also think the final shot and the end and the credit sequence to me are very moving, but for different reasons.
Well, I'm specifically talking about like the Scorsese cameo, where the fact that also what he says in that cameo is the fact that like the murders of the Burkhart family, Molly Burkhart's family, were never acknowledged even in her obit. And so to me, I thought that him really breaking the fourth wall and sort of exposing, yeah, the directorial kind of responsibility, but also inadequacy while telling these stories. Mm-hmm. And that Scorsese is very, while he's doing that reading, he seems to be on the verge of tears. I mean, he's very emotional. Mm. And I thought that was a moment of great sincerity in a movie that is otherwise, you know, like all Scorsese movies, very designed.
Mm-hmm.
So let's wrap up this Killers of the Flower Moon discussion, because I do want to talk about a couple of the other films that I don't think are necessarily contenders, but I would like to talk about them nonetheless. And that would be just very quickly to say, and then we can move on probably, Past Lives. Devika, I hear all of the, like, it wasn't a movie that will win, but there were moments of, I think, like, real probing human experience in that film. Like, the relationship between the husband and then the main character and her, like, friend from her past, like, seeing those exchanges and the kind of grace of allowing a partner to experience this, but also very clearly being uncomfortable with what's going on, not just because you don't speak the language. So there's also like a code thing going on there. But I thought that was nice. But I'm curious what you guys thought about Maestro, which seems to me like extremely campy. And my husband and I, we did watch that film at home, not in the theater, but we were both perplexed as to, like, what is this? Yes, what am I seeing? Is this just a goof? Is it fun? Is it camp? And then the other one is The Holdovers, which I am very interested in how many people seem to have genuinely enjoyed that movie.
Can I ask this? Yeah. I would like to talk about Zone of Interest, too, because I was saying that Killers of the Flower Moon was far and away the best film of the bunch, but I think the Zone of Interest is up in that. But let's start with, go ahead with Past Lives.
Oh no, I think Maestro is the one Eric wanted to talk about. Oh, and Maestro. we have a Maestro champion.
All right, Maestro, man. Let's get into it. I liked Maestro in a way that I can't explain because of how totally over the top and just like go for broke in every aspect, from the filmmaking to the acting to the set design to the costumes. I think that it really won me during the scene when he's old and dancing in a club and it's like purple lights and he's on drugs, Leonard Bernstein, and he's like, and like, it's just, I was like, this is completely strange. Like, I can't believe that this ended up in the final movie, this scene, which seems to have no relationship to the primary plot.
Same with holding the tray of Coke over his head. That was one of my favorite scenes towards the end.
Yeah, that there's like, and just the, his performance, I don't know what to make of it. I just felt like this, I didn't know, I don't know. This seems like a curio to me. Like the movie just was like something else. I don't know if it's like a movie. It's something though.
I think it's a spectacle of commitment. That's what we find so appealing about it. It's like he is so thoroughly in it, even if it's weird, even if it's like, wait, what? Like, even if you're repeating the lines to your partner the next morning in like jokey and campy ways, it's, you know, like, oh, you forgot the piano, man. I mean, there's also like, it was like, oh, yeah.
I mean,
though I will hold out a flame for Carey Mulligan's performance, which there were moments where I did find myself tearing up with.
Hey, I'm not going to lie. Profound. I cried during this movie, but like, I'm a sucker, so I'll cry at everything. But
so Martin Scorsese's cameo was hokey, but Bradley Cooper as Bernstein is not hokey. I mean, to me,
he went for it. If Scorsese had come out with like an old timey radio accent and a curly mustache, then I would have loved that. I would have been all
liked that
in.
Better.
No. Unlike, you know, Oppenheimer, some of the other movies, I don't think this is like a badly made movie. You know, in the sense that I understand people's buy-in into this movie in a way that I don't with a couple of the other nominees.
But it's not really getting, people don't seem to like it, right?
I mean, it's nominated for Best Picture, so I'm just going off of that.
All right, fair.
I just struggle to feel any emotion watching this movie, except, yes, I think moments of Carey Mulligan's performance, but even she, I think, is boxed in a way. Like, all the performances feel like they are, first of all, trying way too hard. I think there's a sense of laboriousness to the performances, but also to the filmmaking. It's just straining too hard. And everything is overly choreographed in a way that I don't think opens up any moments of just genuine vulnerability or emotion. And I do feel like I wish that they had put less effort into getting Bradley Cooper to look and sound like Bernstein and instead just do a performance of a man dealing with all the things that Bernstein was dealing with.
But that would be such a boring movie.
I just could not
get past... You're describing like a biopic.
I mean, I just could not get past his... He sounded like he was just trying so hard to get the voice right. He was trying so hard to get the look right that it almost distracted from emotional investment in the character.
Almost. It entirely distracts from it. It is like watching... I think I said this on our year-end talk, but like to me, it was like watching a film where the central character is a Muppet and all the other people are humans trying to negotiate their relationships with like a large puppet who's flopping around and like does not seem entirely human. So, I mean,
I think that I've never been like, I want to be excited when I see a dream ballet in the middle of a movie, like the dream ballet in Barbie, so much better because it's surprising and it's fun. And here I was like, well, of course there's going to be dream ballet. It's Leonard Bernstein. Like, yeah, okay. And then like a couple scenes later, you're like, and now we're in Marriage Story. And I don't mind the sort of like tonal shift if I felt like it worked better for me. It didn't work for me. And it felt, I think I'm sort of mimicking some other criticisms here, but like mannered, affected.
Oh, yeah. Mannered is definitely,
but not like in the fun May December like way where you're like, you know? Oh yeah, do it all the way up. It was kind of like, oh, now it's a cancer movie. Like, okay, like this is your real life. Like I get you're trying different genres, but I think that the thing that held it all together was some sort of a moral that I think the Oscars can definitely get behind. Which is the most important thing is that the summer's singing you so you can tell a story. And you're like, oh, God, like you need to. And I'm sorry to keep coming back, but that like May December is like, yeah, that's a lie that narcissists tell themselves so they can hurt people. Like, and that is, I just did a winky face. I'm really glad that people listening will not be able to see, but I think maybe it's fun for me to pair up these movies sometimes to be like Maestro and May December, which is
feature.
And that's why I, you know, as someone who doesn't work in the industry, who's never been invited to be in the Academy, like something like May December and people who maybe make their living, make their lives around like making sure that the summer sings in them so that they can make more money in movies and stuff, like might be like attracted to that. But I don't want to be too mean about it because I know it really does mean a lot to Bradley Cooper. And I'm sure he's listening and I don't want to hurt his feelings.
Why do we care about Bradley Cooper's feelings?
I don't really. But I do think like there's such a level of personal investment that that's become part of the conversation around the film, which I don't know.
He's got to recoup his financial investment too. So the guys,
I don't know.
I think,
who was it? One of Bernstein's children said like, I didn't learn anything about my father from this movie, but I learned a lot about Bradley Cooper.
I think that's the bigger indictment of the movie is that, and I am very sympathetic.
The movie is about Bradley Cooper trying to look like Leonard Bernstein rather than about Leonard Bernstein. All I saw in the movie
but that's kind of fun. That's
effort, not character, not reality. I just saw effort in every quarter.
There are a couple images in this movie that I think are like actually interesting, you know, like there's like shots. I do think like the film, like the aesthetic is kind of unified. It's super artificial. It's super controlled, but somehow like, and again, maybe this is just because my expectations were so low going in. I was like, this is the kind of movie that I am going to hate. And then I was like, this movie is totally insane. But I know there's still a couple. There's the scene where they get into an argument during the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade in this like mahogany library, but there's like the balloons are floating by outside and it's super corny and contrived, but somehow like almost surreal. Like he's bumping up into some kind of surrealist aesthetic, I think. Maybe I think I've gone way too far now and I'm defending it.
I get what you guys are saying, even though it didn't like work for me. I do think that there is
doesn't work. It's not a good movie, but it's like
it's almost so, this idea that the movie is more about Bradley Cooper than about Bernstein, it's just so disconnected from reality that it becomes something else.
I think that's right. Exactly. And just to split the difference before we move
it's
on.
It's Brechtian, you know?
but that's what makes it zany and like fun. I mean, I think that you're right that it's pushing and pulling between like the kind of biopic that Clinton, I think rightly, would be afraid for this movie to become, which would be a series of long drawn out set pieces that are rolling us through the greatest hits of his publishing record.
Oppenheimer.
You know, yeah, exactly. But I do also, I walked away from the movie being like, I don't know anything about Leonard Bernstein besides like the headlines. And this didn't fill anything in. Yes. Smoked a lot. Well, that's why he's not the singer. You know, that's why he's just the piano man.
He could really wear like a sweatshirt over a collared shirt. That I came away with. He looked great.
I have one big question about that film, though, is what did Bradley Cooper, how did he direct Sarah Silverman in that movie? What did he tell her to do that is what I saw? I'm not going to say any more than ask that question to the public. What did he tell her to do? Was he like, be Princess Margaret meets somebody's grandma, like my grandmother, my Jewish grand. Like, I feel like that direction was so strange.
It felt a little Joan Rivers to me.
It was like, what is that? But like, it was like also right. Like a little like a good time gal, but also like very specific. I didn't know what he was. He's a horribly aging man. No, like, what did you tell her that was the cut you used? I didn't understand that.
Well, let's move on to Poor Things, because this was...
Speaking of Brechtian.
Yeah, this movie, I will preface this by saying, I enjoyed watching Emma Stone. I enjoyed some parts of the world that it brought us into visually. This was not by yards my favorite Yorgos Lanthimos picture. You know, I think The Favorite is still, as it were, my favorite. I don't think I got this movie, but I also don't think this movie understood itself.
I don't think there's that much to get. I don't think there's that
it's
much
like
to
Barbie,
get.
It's like Barbie, but dressed Barbie. Up in a kind
Absolutely.
Of like, oh, this is auteur-ish.
I think
it's Barbie if she listened to Fiona Apple instead of Dua Lipa.
I saw this
because there's a Spotify playlist and it had Fiona Apple and the Poor Things. Like, if you like Poor Things, listen to Fiona Apple. And I did.
I saw a poster, a meme. Somebody said, like, Poor Things, Yorgos Lanthimos, 2023. And then it was a still from Arrested Development, Jason Bateman and Charlize Theron. Remember, he has this relationship with the character. Yes. And that was
that's
like...
That's a really kind of...
like, kind of like...
Yeah.
That's kind of what this movie is.
Yeah, and that Arrested Development track is like pretty offensive now that you look back and deeply uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. But that said, I think that's a pretty accurate comparison. Right. I think this movie is really fun to look at. I think that is actually true. I think it's the way it's designed. Again, I think it's excessive. Some of my complaints are similar to Maestro, where very simple, and to Oppenheimer, where very simple ideas are dressed up to almost an extent that then they start to feel like disguising an emptiness at the core. You know, when you just overdo the design and the visual effect so much, but don't have a really complex enough story to hold that up. And then it has a theme park vibe to it. But, you know, there is, again, craftsmanship, like in Barbie. I think we gotta admit, concede that this movie exhibits craftsmanship. And I think it's also genuinely really funny at point. Like, I thought Willem Dafoe, frankly, I wasn't that impressed by Emma Stone's performance. I thought Willem Dafoe was incredibly funny. And there are some lines, you know, that he says that just had me cracking up. I think Emma Stone's a great actress. You know, I thought she was just fantastic in The Curse. That is my choice for her performance of the year. I don't think she is very well served by this role in the same way that I don't think some fine actresses in the other movies are well served by their roles, including Lily Gladstone, you know, Emily Blunt and Florence Pugh. I think that this movie's understanding of feminism is really simple and also contemporaneous. Yes. And it's
understanding of politics.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. And it's being transposed onto a past context in a way that feels lazy and pandering. I think this, you know, the characters like awakening to sexism, you know, it is very similar to Barbie, you know, like she goes out into the real world and she's like, wow, men treat you like a sexual object. And there is racism and sexism in this world and racism and classism in this world, it's all so simple. It's just so simple, but the paths taken to arrive at those realizations are so unnecessarily convoluted. It just kind of, it exhausted me. But I'm just saying, like, this is a period when so many ideas around autonomy, ownership are being negotiated that could have really fed into an interesting exploration of what it would have meant to learn to be a woman then. And instead, you know, she's just spouting ideas and realizations that feel very contemporary. That's not very fun. That's not fun to me.
They feel contemporary and familiar. Like, there are moments that I think we're supposed to, like, okay, so I've written about the film. I'm on record. I enjoyed it, but I didn't think it was his best either. And I'll get to that in a second. But I do think some of the discoveries that were supposed to be like really fun and really funny were some of the same discoveries from Barbie, or just some of the discoveries that you know just from being alive, which is like, why would a man care if I sleep around, but think that he could sleep around? I don't know, man. Like, that's the way it is and the way it's always. Like, that didn't like amuse me, because I was like, I felt like a lot of her discoveries, she came to them in a way that was like, she didn't expose anything new through her sort of fresh, naive eyes. There were things I already had thought about and knew about and joked about for my whole life. So like, the feminist discoveries are not big discoveries. I'm not sure what I would want her to discover, but I'm just saying, like, a lot of her, like, it's a lot of the same joke, which is like, she didn't know that men are hypocrites. She didn't know that, like, you have to put pants on, whatever, like things that we all knew. So I think sometimes that runs out of steam. I think Emma Stone does a very brave performance, like a very unselfconscious performance. And I thought about her against Lily Gladstone as the two, like the actress who does a lot and the actress who does very little. And I'm curious to see which the Academy will reward. And I think of Sandra Hüller in Anatomy of a Fall being somewhere in the middle there, which I thought was a good performance too. But bottom line, I think about Poor Things, I loved the final image. I almost felt like I wanted that to be the midpoint of the movie, like this vision of like a new world that she could create that might have been a world that I don't know. And I think that Lanthimos does that with movies like The Lobster and The Favorite. And he didn't do that here, like not just a sort of cosmetically unfamiliar world, but like an ideologically, like an actual world where I'm like, where am I? What is this going to happen here? Like, I didn't know what was going to happen in The Favorite. I didn't know what was going to happen in The Lobster. Yeah. I didn't want to keep watching A Killing of the Sacred Deer. I didn't want to be a part of it. But like, I admired the world building. I hate to use that word, but like just this, like a completely unstable, demented, weird universe. And I think he gets to a sort of good place at the end of the film. And I was sorry that so much of the film was not about that kind of like female utopia possibility. I don't know. But if we'd started there, then maybe we would have really had Barbie again. What I have said about this film, I don't remember if I said this just in conversation or in print, is that it is a movie for people who don't really like Lanthimos movies. They might still like Poor Things. And I felt that way about The Holdovers as well, which is, if you find Alexander Payne too cringe, too mean, I think of him as the crown prince of pettiness. And I love that about him. I love how his characters are impossible to like. Like, I love the kind of like meanness at the core of the election.
Except for in The Holdovers, where they're very likable.
Well, I mean, that's the gentlest movie I think he's made ever. And so if you don't like Alexander Payne, and I have friends who I'll tell them like, go, you got to watch Election. You have to watch like Sideways. And they're like, it sounds like everyone is horrible. And like the message is just like darkness. And I was like, yes, I like the pettiness and pain. I really enjoyed The Holdovers. I saw it with my mom around Christmas. It's a great, and it's really good for what it is, but I felt the same way that I felt about Poor Things, which is like, oh, but I know how weird and bad you can make this. Like, no, not bad, like actually poor quality, and not bad, like 90s rapper bad, but like just like a bad ugliness, like the ugliness of humanity. I know you can get there and you didn't go there. And I'm not surprised that the Academy would prefer those. And I think that I would still recommend those to people who I think would like it. But like, I like their darkest, meanest stuff. Maybe not. Yeah. Killing of a Sacred Deer. Again, Dogtooth, also very hard. But I'm just saying, like, sometimes when they let it get weird, or when they let it get just heady,
Come
on. I like
that. I will say, I will just put it out there that The Holdovers is the only nominee I haven't seen. And
same. Yeah. Oh, so embarrassed to admit it, but now I feel okay.
Well, I don't have anything to say about it, but just in response to what you just said, Annie, I loved Downsizing, which is actually one of his a film of his that actually got a lot of mixed to negative reviews. It is flawed, but it is ambitious also in a way that I really admired. And it does what some of these movies like Poor Things and Barbie don't quite do, even though they are formally so much more accomplished, which is that it takes kind of a slightly ridiculous conceit and pushes it until you discover something about the world we live in. And, you know, that movie was kind of about this solution to climate change and how that seemingly very practical solution actually exacerbates racial class inequities. And, you know, it was a very clever way at getting at the ways in which, you know, the tech industry, for instance, approaches issues like climate change as these problems that can be solved with more entrepreneurial innovation, as opposed to we got to just reckon with the ways in which corporations are destroying the planet and the ways in which, yeah, choice-based solutions really disadvantage people who have less choices at their disposal. And yeah, so anyway, I shouldn't go on and on because I haven't seen The Holdover, so I can't really compare that film to how his previous work holds up. But you mentioned Election, which I love, but I want to always, when I have the opportunity, I want to give Downsizing its flowers.
Mm-hmm. I saw The Holdovers, and I don't have too much to say about it. I think I agree with you, Annie, because I don't think the movie has, it's just, I have very little to say about it because I don't think it's a very interesting movie, ultimately. It doesn't have very much. I'm not sure what he was going for, really. It is like a character piece, for sure. Like, it's a tour de force of acting. But it's also, like, extremely long and probably should be about an hour shorter. And
not that long.
It
How
seems
long is
like it?
Two.
It's for, I'm looking for it like up. A boarding
a
school movie.
I don't think it could be an hour shorter.
Oh, that could take, you know, I would have just cut about an hour off the end.
2 hours and 13 minutes.
Oh,
so
that's long.
Just straining the 45 minutes over.
Over
my,
2 hours.
The sweet spot of the 90
you know,
minute
it's,
feature.
It's the kind of movie where you have multiple scenes that drive home the same point about somebody like slightly gaining some humanity. Over and over again, scenes like at a party where he suddenly realizes he has to be slightly nicer than he is. He can't just be sort of a cold-hearted jerk all the time. Where he becomes a little bit more vulnerable in another scene in a kitchen, you know, and it's the same scene, but it kind of happens again and again as music swells in the background. But other than Paul Giamatti being a good actor, which he is a good actor and he's quite good in this, I think that it's a very sentimental film at heart. And I also feel like we just don't like any of the movies, I'm realizing. And this is like festival brain, I think. We watch a lot of really good movies that no one ever talks about.
I know.
And so then when we're asked to talk about these supposedly good movies that everybody talks about, I don't know, you know, it's a failure. It's our own failure to approach them on their own terms.
I think we're looking at Academy Award nominated films, and that's a particular kind of film, and it can't be too challenging. I think The Holdovers, it's just, it's hard for me sometimes when I'm like, I like a lot of movies, like whether I want to fully put the weight of my endorsement behind it is always trickier. I find that I use like words like satisfying when I write about movies because it gave me what I came for. But it's harder for me to find movies that gave me something I didn't expect or that I was like more than I expected.
On that note, though, I do want to ask about The Zone of Interest, which I do think is an extremely challenging and ambiguous, a complex movie, let's call it.
And let's wonder why a movie that is so complex and ambiguous is on the Best Picture nominees list alongside these other ones. I think it says something to the fact that the movie is not that complex.
Okay, maybe not that complex, but certainly ambiguous. Let's say that.
About what?
About like its indictment of, I don't know. That's why I'm still trying to figure it out.
But isn't it just the indictment of the everyday of the banality of evil? I mean, that's the point of the movie, right?
No, like, I don't think so. I think it's about the scene I keep thinking about is the scene that shoots forward to the Auschwitz Museum, where you have this compartmentalization of the trauma, of the violence, and this narrativization of the horror that we've seen before. And it's really like this is a movie where that move to me kind of point is saying like you're watching these things on a screen. When you learn about this, when you go watch Schindler's List, when you go to the Auschwitz Museum, when you go to the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C., you're narrativizing something that cannot be boiled down to such simple terms. You can look at a large pile of shoes that's behind a glass wall in an utterly antiseptic museum. But the fact that this monument, this museum has been created is itself like a way for a society to kind of compartmentalize and process these horrible things. So the movie is about, to me, not just this particular event, not just the Holocaust. It's about the way that like people tell stories about things to make sense of them, about horrible things to make sense of them. And people simplify things to make sense of them. People look at horrible things happening and create narratives that allow them to get through their day and create systems of power, ideas of stories about the way that things happened. I don't know. To me, that's what it's about, rather than the banality of evil, which is like not a very interesting idea.
He's like in charge of Auschwitz. So I feel like it's not particularly banality. He's like the heart of darkness.
I mean, showing this like everyday folks.
Yeah.
You know, and they're like taking like, fur coats. Well, they're taking fur coats from the prisoner. I mean, it's so.
They know about it too. It's not as if to me, like that's the thing. Like the idea that they're like, it's just, they know that it's bad.
Yeah.
And they're like trying to not think about it. Like, it's not like it's banal.
Like, it's not just following orders. These are the people that are making the orders. In fact.
And there's also that scene with his mother where the mother leaves. And the mother-in-law leaves because she can't handle it because she can't process it in the way that they're processing.
That's why I'm like, I don't fully buy the idea that this movie is about how people just make stories to get through horrible things, because I don't think of this characters in this movie as representative of regular people. They are not people who are
totally.
Like, for example, many of us are right now looking at what's happening in Gaza, and people have drawn that parallel with the movie. How do we kind of move through life when something is happening more proximately to some of us, less proximately to some of us? But this movie is about the people, is about the guy who ran Auschwitz. So this is why I kind of struggle with like what the movie is really trying to do, because I don't know if any of us can look at Rudolf Hess and his family and necessarily take away lessons that apply to us. And so I
don't agree with that. I mean, I think that like the movie definitely, especially in the scene where we see the Auschwitz Museum, I think that like the idea is that we are complicit in these horrors.
I mean, is that really a hugely novel idea to drive home
it's not a hugely novel idea, but it certainly isn't saying that like we don't have anything to do with the evil of Rudolf Hess and his family.
No, it's not saying that, but I think our complicity is different from the complicity of the commandant of Auschwitz. That's not complicity. That is a relation of power.
Sure.
That is a direct relation of power and profit and capital. And that's why I don't know. I mean, I think this movie is doing something interesting, but I think that it's
the same complaint
I have with Oppenheimer, that it is driving home a very simple idea with extremely convoluted formal tactics that make it seem deeper than it is, that he recreated the Hoss's house and put up
these
cameras.
What's the simple idea in your reading of it?
I think the idea that it's trying to get across, that we are all complicit and people compartmentalize evil to get on with their lives, is pretty simple. And I think that that is a very simple idea to convey using a set of characters who I think represent a lot more than that. It's portraying the Hosses, but I don't think it's really getting at... I mean, I first of all don't know if it's that interesting to watch a movie about the Hosses, first of all, or to make a movie about them. There is already a lot of art and archival work around the Nazis, like everyday lives, you know, their relations of power and profit with respect to the victims of the Holocaust. And so I just don't find this to be a particularly interesting concept. And then this kind of reconstruction of their space and how experientially they might have moved through this particular situation, to me, is a little bit besides the point, because again, they designed this situation. It's not like they were experiencing a situation that was not of their making. Rudolf Hess played very much a part in designing this situation. So it's not clear to me what idea the movie is driving beyond, Clint, what you're saying. And I think what you're saying about this idea of complicity narrativizing horror seems like pretty simple to me and not something that needed a reconstruction of the Auschwitz commandant's house.
I would say, though, that it is more complex than what if we blow up the world? What if we already did? I don't know if that's like a fair comparison to look at Oppenheimer and Zone of Interest as reckoning, like doing it in the same way. I think that Zone of Interest does it way better. That would be my opinion. And I think I'm going a lot by like, how did it make me feel? But I felt like the crying child in Zone of Interest and not knowing what side of the wall the crying is coming from was very affecting to me. It really, I found it to be a very upsetting film. And maybe in that sense, I would say that it is more of an sort of an emotional journey than it is an intellectual one, maybe just for me. And I found that the ending, when it shoots forward in time, now I am going to footnote this with the footnote meaning I forget who said this, somebody on the internet. But like what's important is not that they flash forward, but that they go back. That going back to him is like where the meaning is. What is the meaning? I don't know. I did not have time to prepare for that for today. I haven't figured it out. But I do think if it had just flashed forward, I've been like, oh, all right. That would have been like an audio visual version of like a title card saying like Rudolf Haas died at the age of what? Like, okay, we know where the ending is. But the idea that we would go back, maybe that's meant to say something about the contemporary that we all live at. There's some kind of like space-time uniting of horror. Maybe he's vomiting because he has a glimpse of what is to come, even if he can't articulate it. I don't know what is happening, but I thought the ending was something I wanted to keep thinking about and reading about and trying to figure out. And I thought that some of that creation of the space was really provocative. I don't know what it meant, though. Like, and it's possible it didn't mean as much. Like, maybe the meaning falls somewhere between your two points of view in terms of like how rich and actually generative those thoughts were. But I do think that it didn't act like it had the answers in the way that I feel like Oppenheimer acted like it was answering a question that I felt like it was like, well, that was barely a question and they didn't answer it. Whereas Zone of Interest, I really did want to know the answers. And I wouldn't necessarily say like, oh, I can't wait to see it again, but I haven't totally let go of it. And I feel like means something. Because I've let go of a number of the films from this year. I've just kind of brain dumped them.
Zone of Interest 2. If they win the Oscar, mark my words, making the prediction. Zone of Interest 2.
That is dark.
Yeah.
Okay, so now that we've gone through all of our best pictures, I want, as we kind of wrap up here, I want to take a moment to just talk about films, you know, and we can really only kind of list them, but films that we didn't see represented in these picks that we nonetheless loved. I'll go first only because these choices are probably most embarrassing. I very much enjoyed Saltburn. I know that it is, I'm not dying on the hill of Saltburn, but I very much enjoyed it. It was everything I love from Emerald Fennell. I think it was sharp in some ways, dull in others, but also a great vehicle for Barry Cogan. And there's other complications there. I also loved Bottoms, which would never appear on these lists, but like I laughed from start to finish, and that never happens for me with comedy. I also really loved a Chilean horror film called When Evil Lurks that I thought was a very interesting take on the kind of body possession, body horror, had a political allegory that flew right over my head because I don't know the context, but thoroughly enjoyed that. And also You Hurt My Feelings, which I felt was the most honest movie about a relationship that involves at least one creative and a spouse. And how the, one responds
Nicole
to that.
Nicole Holof Center. That would also be one of my favorites of the year. And I did write about that one. It's one of her best films.
And a great double feature with American Fiction, I think.
Yes.
I want to see that.
Yeah.
All right, Annie, what about you? What were some of the films that you wish were there?
I want a second. You Hurt My Feelings. I want to bring out All of Us Strangers, which I didn't love the ending, but I was like, what is this movie? I thought it was something else. But until
it's the gay Sixth
the
Sense.
Final. Yeah, I don't like, you know, I don't really want a twist in like if you give me a twist at the end, I'm probably never going to watch it again because then I can only watch it through the twist. But until that ending, I really did feel like I was watching sort of like an English language petite maman, like some kind of like weird journey. And I really thought that Andrew Scott was so good in it. And I liked those performances and I liked the mood. I think it got a little in its own way about like trying to explain what was happening and justify it rather than just like let it be a 90-minute dream. Because I liked it when it was a dream and I didn't like the ending, but I still felt like Scott could have been nominated and I wouldn't have begrudged him that because I didn't really think it was the performance's weakness that they sort of like felt like they needed to raise the stakes of the movie at the end. And I was like, there were no stakes. It was just here. We're here. We're all in it. I was liking it. You can't see me, but I liked it. But I did check that one out because that was one of the films. I hadn't seen it until the Oscar nominations came out. And that was one of the films that that some people felt very betrayed. And so I wanted to check it out. And I mentioned Polite Society. So that's another one. Two movies I really would. I'd like to see Dream Scenario with Nicolas Cage. I'm sorry, I haven't seen that one yet.
I enjoyed that one.
And I want to see Drive Away Dolls. Those are two of my looking forward
movies. What was the second one, Annie?
Drive Away Dolls.
Oh, okay.
But that's 2024, right?
But I'm just saying like, I want to see that. So I can't say anything about those. I wish, but yes, speaking on this year, I would say May, December, it was, I think, a big snub. I was very disappointed about that not being included in any meaning, except for the script, which I was like, yeah, but they sold it. Performance is sold it.
The script was great, but that was
like just a piece of that bigger puzzle. And I think that there could have been something for All of Us Strangers that was, and Polite Society is a big one for me for people to enjoy with anyone. It's such a fun movie and it's smart and you can watch it with all kinds of people and they will probably like it too. And you won't have to have a fight afterwards.
All right. What about you, Devika?
My 20 best films of the year list is available on filmcommon.com. And not a single one of them is nominated for Best Picture. And only one of them has any nomination at all. And that is May, December, which is for script, which I just want to say, I think May, December, huge snub. I am glad that Sammy Birch got recognized, though, because it's her, I believe, her first feature script. And it's a fantastic piece of writing, I think. And it's really cool to see her recognized. But the film is formally so accomplished on so many levels, performance and direction, especially that very disappointing that that was not recognized. I can read off a couple of the titles on my best films of the year list, of best films of 2023 list. So I loved Pacifiction, which is a film by the director Albert Serra, the Catalan director Albert Serra, which I think is streaming on Hulu maybe, and is just a really excellent film in the genre of colonialist, a bumbling colonialist in the tropics. You know, that is the genre that I define as bumbling colonialist in the tropics. It's about this French diplomat in Tahiti, in French Polynesia. And it's about his little maneuverings there, while in the background, there are rumors that France is secretly starting up nuclear testing in the waters in the Pacific near the islands again, which France actually did in the 1990s. And that was a big political issue. And so that's kind of the premise of the film, but it is really a film of vibes, as people like to say. Mm-hmm. And it's about how much vibes kind of are part of neocolonial systems, you know, rumors and conspiracies that no one knows if they reflect the truth or not. And this kind of very dispersed, diffused workings of power that even those people who are the cogs of the system can't always pin down. And it has some like really fantastic shots, especially of the ocean, of people surfing in the ocean. So I thought that was a very strong film. I loved Kelly Reichardt's showing up.
Oh, come on. Just,
what?
I said just don't take that one from me.
I'll let Clint say more about it. But I think it's one of her best films. It has Michelle Williams in a performance that is not showy at all in the way that a lot of other performances that get recognized by the Oscars are. But I think it is the most kind of feminist performance of this year in kind of showing us all that a woman can be, especially a woman artist. So showing up. And the fourth film on my list might be a bit obscure. It's Youth Spring by the Chinese documentarian Wang Bing. It's 3.5-hour film set in these garment workshops in China. And it's a feat of editing, you know, first and foremost. I think it's the way it compresses this enormous amount of footage that Wang Bing captured into something that both conveys the tedium of life as a worker, especially in these private workshops in China, the tedium and also the relentlessness, you know, the repetition and relentlessness that is the condition of the modern worker, sort of. So I'll shout those out. I don't think Youth Spring was ever could have ever been a contender for the Oscars, but it was my one
that.
Of my favorite
It could have been
films.
In the documentary competition.
Nah,
right?
The documentary nominees no? tend to be very pat
That's
and
true.
Very narrative-based, and this is not a film with a narrative.
Showing once again why I have no sense for... I'm not a betting man. It's probably wise. I'll be brief. I also like showing up a lot. I do think Michelle Williams, in a perfect world, again, clearly there's no world in which she was going to get nominated or showing up was going to get nominated, but I feel like her performance is one of the best of the year. Passive Fiction is also just this dreamlike miasma of paranoia and orange and yellow sunsets. That is a really incredible movie.
We have a hive mind.
Oh. Yeah.
I want to throw something out for the haters. I really liked Asteroid City. I'm just going to put that out there too. I really liked it. I don't know.
The haters, you say. One of them is right here, Annie.
I'm sure. Yeah. Well, it's like one of the few films where I was like, I don't believe this dialogue, but I'm okay with it. You know, it wasn't.
Yeah. It's vibes. I think, as Devika was saying earlier, I think if you're there for the Wes Anderson vibes.
I think I'm there for like the delivers. 1950s Actors Studio meets Aliens. Like that, I feel like you created like some kind of mid-century.
I think he's going to go through the looking glass pretty soon, Wes Anderson. And the critical consensus
like
will shift. Yeah, you're going to like it more. People are going to like it more. People are going to be like, wow, everything is fake. Everything is
fake. Maybe that's it. Yeah.
The other movie I want to shout out, which nobody mentioned, was Earth Mama, which was a beautiful film about a young single mother in Oakland that I don't feel like got a lot of attention, but it did seem like trending more towards the Oscar world. But, you know, again, I clearly have no sense for what that is. So,
yeah, if there was an A24 produced first Oscars. Feature by a woman that deserved to be up there. I'm throwing a little bit of shade at past lives. It should have been Earth. It should have been Earth Mama. It's a fantastic film.
I second that. And then finally, this is for the haters, Priscilla, a movie that I liked a lot, but no one liked that I could, that I've met ever. So
Jacob Elordi
was like,
very pretty to look
at. That's in my notes, Priscilla, which is that I didn't like Priscilla. I love Laurie Marceau's article on the page. She wrote a great piece about it called Burn Book. But I feel a lot of compassion for it when I found out that Sofia Coppola just got like the funding pulled and had to finish it.
I mean, to me, it's
some
like
of
this,
the pacing issue for
right.
me, which is like,
well,
why
to me,
do
I
we
love
ever
the pacing issue? I thought like the movie was like leaning into being as boring and hellish as possible in a way that I like. Again, like apparently I'm sort of a glutton for boring.
I just think no
movies,
more official biopics.
Yes,
you know?
I think that was part of the problem here. Is there's a very clear push and pull. No, I think there's a push and pull between like Priscilla, the human being who wants to tell a story, but maybe also doesn't want to tarnish the reputation of her husband, but also still does want to get in certain things.
Right.
And so we're left with a kind of like cutting room floor situation.
I think you leave this movie thinking that Elvis is like a psycho, right?
Yes, I did.
So I think this does not push and pull too hard. To me, that's enough. Like, I was like, cool. This movie's about how Elvis was like a total sociopath. And like, and that's like a pretty weird perspective on Elvis that I'm like interested to kind of, that I'm glad is a part of our cultural world. Yeah, that's it. I'm done. I'm out.
Okay, so let's do a very quick lightning round as we close up. It's been marvelous talking about all of these films with you guys. So very quick, best picture. Who do we think will win? It sounds like it's Oppenheimer.
I'm going to say Killers.
But it could also be Killers of the Flower Moon.
I'm going to put my weight behind Killers.
I think it's going to be, if I was doing a pool, I would put it on Oppenheimer.
Mm. I'm putting my chips on Oppenheimer.
All right. What about Best Director? I think here probably is going to be Scorsese, Killers of the Flower Moon.
Has he never won?
I don't know.
No, he won for The Departed. Yeah. He won for The Departed, which at times this felt like The Departed, like when Leo's getting spanked. Spoiler. I was like, oh, I've seen this before. And it's not because I've been in, you know, it's not like I've been on in Saint-Tropez with him. So there must have been another movie. And then I was like, oh, Scorsese likes to, you know, punish him.
I can't really say why, but in my mind, it's flipped. I think Nolan is going to win Best Director, and Killers is going to win Best Picture.
Did he already win?
Interesting.
He already won, though.
So?
Nolan? Isn't he
yeah,
like...
Yeah, that won't matter necessarily again. For the Academy.
I think that the Killers is like a movie that you want to say is, you know, movie for our times. And I think Nolan is so flashy directorially that that might be bad.
Okay.
That's my logic.
I'm going to do something weird and do a projection that, like, I think probably won't come true, but some little piece of me thinks it will. The Today Show did, like, one about horoscopes. I don't know what they predicted, but I'm having, like, sort of, like, the moon is in retrograde, and I think it's going to be Justine Triet for Anatomy of a Fall. I don't know why.
That was my choice for what I wish would have won. But
I don't know why,
but
I feel like there's a chance that people will be like, there's that movie is a little bit about like being a director, like, you know, staging things and trying to figure out the truth. And there's kind of an ambiguity, but it also feels like a Hollywood art film. And I just think there's a possibility that they could divide between like Nolan and Scorsese, these big guys.
I don't think they're going to give it to Scorsese. I don't think Scorsese is going to win anything.
I think it's going
to
be Triet. That's my guess. But if it ends up being Nolan, I'm going to be like, well.
Yeah. I think Lily Gladstone's going to win, though. I will say that. I think
well,
she's going to
win. Okay, let's move into Best Lead Actress.
That's a done deal. Yeah.
I agree with Clinton. I think it's Lily Gladstone.
Lily's a done deal.
Yeah, I think.
But that, precludes Scorsese winning Best Director and Best, in my mind, because I don't think that movie was popular. Like, I think that's the best movie of the Best Picture nominees, Killers of the Flower Moon, but I don't think it's perceived as being Scorsese's masterwork, right? Am I wrong? By the general public. So, I don't know.
What about lead actor? Last category.
Well,
Cillian Murphy.
It's got to be Bradley Cooper.
I think it's going to be Cillian. I think it's going to be Cillian, and we're going to see sad Bradley Cooper memes after.
Listen, I'm praying for Bradley Cooper because I just think that's like the chaos option. But I think like of this selection, Paul Giamatti is probably the real best of actor and best performance of these.
I also thought Jeffrey Wright was really great though. And they're kind of
also good,
similar movies in a way.
But not
I mean, they have a
acting.
Different vibe, but like
Jeffrey Wright was great, but the amount of acting that Cillian Murphy and Bradley Cooper do, they are acting so hard and there's so
and
much
Giamatti.
Acting squeezed into every minute of their screen time.
Yeah.
So tiring sometimes.
And Giamatti's
a quantity
performance
game.
Is pretty exhausting too.
The Oscars.
Yes. He also has a physical transformation on his side. Like, that's important. Giamatti has the lazy eye in the movie.
I think it's going to be Murphy, not because I think Divine Joy Randolph is going to win Best Supporting. Mm-hmm. And I think that's how the Academy is going to reward that movie. I don't think they'll do it for both. I think a lot of ballots are going to vote. Not that everyone's coordinating with everyone, but I think a lot of people are going to give their vote to Divine Joy Randolph and then give it to Cillian Murphy. If she lost, then, because I think they'll do supporting first, then I would be, if I was in an Oscar pool, I would be one of those people who's like, can I change my vote? And I don't know. I'd probably be running it and I would let myself change my vote. Because if she doesn't win, then I'm going to think that a lot of people voted for Paul Giamatti because not only is he very good in that movie, and that movie was a big crowd pleaser and a movie that I like, despite its lack of pettiness and meanness at its heart, I do think that like, Paul Giamatti has a lot of, I think there's just a lot of goodwill towards him. I think Cillian Murphy's a good guy, but he goes home to Ireland. And I think that Paul Giamatti is like, he's not a Nepo baby, but he's been in the business for a long time. And I think that people will want to give him his Oscar. And I think they're going to feel like this is the movie to give it to him for. So I'm talking myself out of it.
I think it's going to be Cillian
Murphy
because
everybody
loves Oppenheimer.
If Randolph, who was great, if she loses, then I'm going to think, oh, no. Giamatti's game.
All right. Well, we will have to let our listeners see how we did on the scoreboards and our final pools.
Can I quickly say one thing? I do think Robert Downey Jr. will win for Best Supporting Actor, and I think he should. Again, I think he's the only and best thing about Oppenheimer.
And I also have a final note, which I like to mention every time we do an Oscars discussion. And I think it's especially relevant this year when we had two major Hollywood strikes. Never forget that the Academy Awards were invented as a union-busting tactic by Louis B. Mayer.
All right. So with those notes, we will close out. It has been my pleasure to speak with all of you about the Oscars and the year in movies. I've been speaking with Annie Burke, Clinton Crute, and Devika Girish. Thank you all so much for joining me.
Thank you, Eric.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Film Comment podcast features original music by Greg Einge. Film Comment is a publication of Film at Lincoln Center. Since 1962, Film Comment has been the home of independent film journalism, publishing in-depth interviews, critical analysis, and feature coverage of mainstream, arthouse, and avant-garde filmmaking from around the world. Visit us online at filmcomment.com.